previously on the Babylon podcast.
Hey there. Okay, let me call you back in a minute. Bye.
In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And that's it for this week.
I'm Jeffrey here.
Are you going to join us?
I'm here. I haven't been here for like forever. I mean, you kicked me out of the studio and let Jeffrey record it last week. Jeez.
That was a request, I seem to recall.
Yes, it was.
That was a please let me out of the cage.
Yes, it was.
did you enjoy your little slice of fresh air?
Yes, I did. Actually, I saw the sun. It was nice. There's actually grass on the ground. That's really cool. I haven't seen that in a long time. So that was quite enjoyable.
Very good. Very good. Well, don't have a whole lot of news to kick off with. I did read something, and I haven't downloaded it, but apparently JMS's appearance at New York Comic Con may or may not occur because there is the British equivalent of the Oscars occurring about that time, and apparently Changeling is up for awards.
A BAFTA, really?
Interesting.
Sorry?
And so that's the BAFTAs?
Yes. So, he's not in the last news group message that went out. He said he's not sure if he's going to, depending upon how much time it will take, will depend upon whether or not he's able to attend New York Comic Con. So, anyways, as we find out more news, we'll pass that along.
Cool. You know, I do have something for you guys.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I think there is one person that would like to say hi.
Babcom link established.
Hi, guys. Did you miss me?
Oh, my. It's Yarsto.
Yes, it's Yarsto. I'm back.
And where have you been, Yarsto?
The Netherlands. Where else?
Well, I figured you're a globetrotting sort of guy, right?
Nah. Globe-trotting sort of guy. Unfortunately, no globe-trotting sort of budget.
And here we thought the Vorlons had captured you and taken you back to their home world to start modifying you.
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about the probes. Jeffrey's way too mean in the way he sticks them in. That's all I'm saying.
Oh.
That's just wrong.
Hear your voice.
And you love it, don't you, Mike?
Well, I'm glad you finally surfaced. People were wondering where you'd been and what part of the planet you'd fallen off of.
Yeah, no real falling off the planet, just trying to get used to being insanely busy. One of the ways I actually coped with it, Summer, was chatting to you occasionally on Skype. Whenever I hear your to-do list, I suddenly feel I'm not busy.
I'm glad I can provide such a bright, shining beacon for everyone's lives. But you guys are ramping up with more Voices of Babylon, right?
Yeah, we've got the new set of scripts out, hoping to get most of the audio in by the weekend. Mike's talking to me about my microphone settings again. So hoping to get most of the audio in by the weekend and then get everything mixed up and start transmitting new episodes in February. So
great.
Exciting times there as well.
No, you had also put out the call for scripts apart from Three-Edged Sword to come out through Voices of Babylon. Have you had any takers on that?
We've had no definite takers yet. We have had, actually, before we sent out the call, we'd already had someone expressing an interest, so we're seeing what will happen there.
Very good. Very good. Well, you know what? I wanted to share something here real quick. This is sort of a little personal story, and I'll try to make it quick. And we'll use this as a segue into our deep geeking. As I was thinking about the episode, it reminded me of an incident from many years back, early on in my career as a graphic designer. And to try to make a long story short, I was a junior designer, had a senior designer. We reported to a department manager who then reported to like a division head kind of thing. Well, this division head was doing a presentation in front of some big clients. We were supposed to provide him with some visual materials, and basically we dropped the ball, and literally while his presentation was going on, we were making, you know, the next set of graphics and feeding them out through the company. And this is before a whole lot of digital stuff, so it was like, you know, printed out and running into the meeting room. And it was kind of a disaster for that reason and others. So the upshot was, afterwards, there was, might as well call it an inquest from our manager trying to figure out what happened. So I get called into his office, and he starts asking me about my part in it. And as he gets going, he starts really harping on the fact of, well, you know, did the senior designer, did he communicate with you the deadline? Did he communicate this to you? And as we're going through it, I suddenly realized what he was looking for was for me to hang this designer, who was also a friend, basically to twist in the wind as a sacrificial lamb for this division manager. It was a really, really weird sensation. And once I kind of realized that that was what was going on, I didn't so much stonewall, but I took responsibility for my part of it and didn't give him what he wanted. And we spent about 3 or 4 minutes with him obviously trying to get the answer he wanted to get the senior designer's head on a peg for his boss.
Wow.
Yeah. And now what does this have to do with our episode tonight?
A little bit of everything, actually.
That's exactly right. So, Summer, what do you say we take a break and then come back and deep geek on intersections in real time?
All righty, then. We'll be back in just a moment.
On the next Babylon 5.
Cooperation will be rewarded. Resistance will be punished.
They know there's only one way to control Sheridan.
Even you can be broken.
No!
And that's why they must destroy his mind.
You cannot resist.
But once he belongs to them, will he turn against his own people?
You'd be surprised.
On the next Babylon 5.
How to continue a television series after a major actor has left the cast. Part 2. The Blake 7 Method.
Remove the character from the scripts. Introduce a new replacement character. Eventually, few of the original characters will be present, and the series will barely resemble its original form.
For more about British science fiction television, listen to the British Invaders podcast. www.britishinvaders.com.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
And we are back to Deep Geek on what for me was probably the most difficult episode to watch. Intersections yeah. in real time.
Even more so difficult than to watch your car get whipped?
Yes.
I think so, for me at least. The whole psychological angle is way down on the easy viewing list.
So what was it about it, Summer, that made it difficult for you to watch?
I think it was the relentless focus on what Sheridan was being put through. Because there was no A story, there was no B story, there was just this story.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get a lighter toned respite. You got literally railroaded. You were pulled along this one single solitary unbreaking chain of just relentless psychological manipulation of Sheridan. And it was the first time I watched it, I squirmed a lot.
Uh-huh.
And just I'm thinking that was part of the story structure, because he's going through that with no break. So we as viewers, we don't get to cut away to someone else's, you know, to what's going on in the battles. We are here. We have no sense of time. We have no sense of anything except what he's being put through in this box with his confessor, so to speak.
Not his tormentor?
He doesn't see it that way.
Right. Well,
the fact that he doesn't see it that way is what makes this so difficult for me to watch. It's basically what happens with Jakar is just trying to break his pride and, in a way, his body. This is really trying to break a mind and a sense of reality. And that's very powerful, I think.
Yeah. And one of the ways that the interrogator does it is he tells Sheridan, he's not going to lie to him. He's going to be truthful with him, but the truth is very fluid, and he's not always giving him the truth when he needs it. And I'm thinking specifically of that bit with the corned beef sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's okay. You know, the whole deal. Well, you know, the corned beef's really good. You got to have the right kind of mustard, and Sheridan needs it. And the interrogator says, "Okay. Oh, and by the way, you know, it's a funny thing about poisons." You know, and he's not lying to Sheridan. He tells him straight up, okay, you know, you've just eaten this. But on the other hand, he doesn't stop Sheridan from eating it.
Yeah, it's a little half-truth in there. He said, well, you saw me eat half of it. Oh, they don't want you dead. They need you alive.
Right. Yeah, and I'm with you at that point, Summer. Part of what made me squirm, I'm sure we've all been in those cases where we've thrown up what we've eaten for the last 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to relate to being physically drained that way.
The little bit of torture in there is telling him it's going to happen. It's like, oh yeah, you'll start feeling it in a few minutes. And you see the look on his face where he probably makes it worse by anticipating it.
Yeah.
But that's part of the process that they've chosen. And I chose the word confessor for him because that's all he wants. He wants Sheridan to confess that he was wrong, to confess that he was manipulated by aliens bent on overthrowing Earth, and nothing more. He wants a confession. He doesn't care if it's true or not in from the government's viewpoint or from Sheridan's viewpoint. He just wants to get the confession.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that really struck me this time around watching it is the one little angle that they're hanging the alien manipulation bit on, and that is the fact that Sheridan has been a soldier, and a soldier follows orders. And there's the unspoken assumption is that because a soldier follows orders, he is not capable of thinking for himself. Therefore, you know, the out, as it were, is that Sheridan wasn't thinking for himself. Others were thinking for him. And you get, you know, when the interrogator, the confessor, is working that bit with him, you can see it in Sheridan's face, like, you know, you guys don't believe I could come to this of my own free will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost as much a damning aspect of the whole thing, you know, or not a damning aspect, but I think is emblematic of the theme of the individual versus the state.
You get a sense that as much as the interrogator is trying to brainwash Sheridan, he himself has probably been at least as brainwashed, that he's not thinking for himself either, really.
Would you say then, Yarstow, at that point when, as the interrogation goes forward and his apparent failure to break Sheridan becomes more and more apparent, and he gets the interrogator, as you recall, he starts getting nervous, is that, do you see that as part of the process of trying to break Sheridan, or do you think on the confessor's part that is truly him getting nervous because he's not capable of fulfilling what's expected of him?
I'm not 100% certain on that one. you'd have to ask JMS to be sure. But the way I see it, yeah, I see it as him really... Part of it is probably a play directed at Chardon, but I also think part of it is actually the realization that there's someone he can't break, and the fact that he isn't used to that even being possible, because nobody's told him that's possible.
I see it as part of the game, because a lot of that was more along the lines of, at the very beginning, he says, I don't care, you know, I'm just here to get the job done. Then all of a sudden he cares about Sheridan's life. It's like he spent the whole beginning trying to deny any empathy, any empathic connection between, you know, interrogator and subject. But then at the end, all of a sudden, he's trying to use a connection that was never built up to convince Sheridan, sign this and I can save your life. And what I got from the earlier part was that when he pointed out that your record shows you have no political bent, but all of a sudden you do have a political bent, that is coming more from the fear of the administration, saying it's like, what can we do when one of our own war heroes turns against us? I believe that part in that last conversation with the first interrogator was true, because they didn't know what to do about him. You have someone who has the weight of being a war hero questioning the government, and that lends credibility, enough credibility to where other people will start to listen to the questions that person has raised, and that poses a huge threat to Clark. And that's the conundrum that Clark and his people found themselves in. Like, we can't discredit him completely because he has a history that the people understand and respect. So what do we do?
So from that point, though, this is something that I've been contemplating and wrestling with, and I don't have answers. The fact that, as the confessor says, they're willing at this point to fabricate something. It's not as good as if it's the real thing in front of a crowd, but that's what they'll settle for. So why doesn't Clark and his cronies eliminate Sheridan at that point? Why did they go for yet another round of this interrogation game?
It strengthens the resolve of the rebellion, so to speak. If Sheridan's dead, he becomes yet one other reason for them to keep fighting even harder. Like, look, they tricked our leader, they captured him, they killed him. Now we have someone more to fight for. And if you think about it, they kind of have to remember what Delenn said at the beginning when they almost took Babylon 5 in Season 3. She said, no human captain has defeated a Minbari fleet in combat. You're in front of me. You know,
yeah,
the one who's
behind me.
Yeah, he's behind me. And, you know, if the man she loves is killed, what could her rage, her grief, help spark with the people who are fighting against Clark? You don't want a martyr, and you don't want that kind of anger coming down on you at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree that that would necessarily play consciously into their plans. I think like you were saying initially, it's more of a martyr kind of thing, even though at that point they tell Sheridan, we're willing to deal with the ramifications of killing you as opposed to breaking you. I think that might be, again, part of the game. Get him to the point where he can steel himself, all right, now at least there's an end coming, and I can prepare for that, and I have strength for that, and then there's not that end. You know, it's yet again another round of, you know, interrogations and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's part of the political game they're trying to play. They want to break him, to get him to recant, to be remorseful about what he's done, and that way it has a resolution that doesn't leave lingering questions for other people to ask and make trouble with.
Right. Right. So now here's another aspect to it that I keep trying to interpret. The bit with the Drazi. they bring the Drazi in, who is apparently confessing that he was the one who had influence, or at least, you know, part of the cabal that influenced Sheridan and his officers to turn against Earth. And Sheridan, of course, is trying to tell him, no, don't give in. This is what they want. Be strong. Okay? When they haul Sheridan away into the next room, there's the hooded figure who then reveals himself to the Drazi, to be the Drazi, and who then leaves the room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, this is after Sheridan has had the vision of Delenn. Okay? I have never been certain as to whether or not that Drazi in the hood was really there.
Really?
Yeah.
I always saw him as part of the game.
Now, the way I see it, that Drazi is basically a deliberate attempt to try to completely break Sheridan's sense of reality.
Well, it worked for me, because like I said, there, you know, times I watch it, and it's like, okay, you know, he's an actor, a pawn in the game. And then there are times where that smile he gives before he leaves the room, I see it as the smile that says, hang in there, you'll make it.
No, that was totally a, you know, ha-ha, gotcha smile to me. Because we didn't see him. I think it was a bad trick of the lighting when they first bring Sheridan in the room. He's supposed to look like the executioner, you know, room 17. That's where you're going to go to be
right.
killed. But the way that it's lit, you can tell from the hood that it's the Drazi, you know, the head shape under there. So I think that was an accidental giveaway. We're not supposed to know the executioner isn't the executioner until he takes the hood off. And then that, because you see the look on Sheridan's face where he goes, "It's you, what?" And my thinking is they just brought him in to show him that they could break anyone, you know, even someone, you know, as stubborn as Drazi, they could break him, get him to say what they wanted, and use that as sort of my thinking was they thought that Sheridan was subverted by alien influence, so he would have, you know, more empathy towards an alien about to be executed, and that would cause him to break down and confess.
Sure, but why would the Drazi go through, if that part of it was a charade, why have the Drazi go with Sheridan's direction, or his you know, Sheridan convinces him not to sign the confession, don't give them what they want, stand up. And so the Drazi apparently bucks up and refuses to cooperate. So if the whole deal is to break Sheridan by showing they can break a race of proud people like the Drazi, why, you know, and then we reveal that he's part of the whole game, why play it that way? That's what I don't understand. And I guess that's why, again, I keep flipping back and forth to wondering whether or not that was he hallucinated that Drazi to begin with, you know, in that latter scene.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's part of the game. Basically, if he can convince someone else to back away from that brink, it gives him strength to stay away from it himself. And therefore, when, you know, it's a punishment, like the confessor was talking about before, you know, if, you know, lack of cooperation yields in a punishment. Only this time the punishment, instead of punishing Sheridan with pain or illness, they're going to punish the Drazi, you know, give a little bit of guilt to Sheridan, make him think that was his fault, and try to play on that as one more spike to break him.
I see it a little different from that still. Hmm. The way I see it is the Drazi was basically in it all along, and what they're doing, when it turns out that just showing this Drazi in panic won't break Sheridan, is then they have him play along, and the next step is to bring him back and basically show, we completely control your reality. Nothing here is real unless we want it to be real. To really try to break down the sense of reality that Sheridan needs in order to resist.
Yeah, you know, and from a bigger point of view, one of the things that I really like about this episode, I think this is the culmination of those theatrical episodes that JMS had created throughout the show. You know, you harken back to elements of The Sky Full of Stars with Sinclair in Night One, You think about Comes the Inquisitor with Sebastian and Delenn. And while those are great episodes, there's still this kind of sci-fi element that pervades through that. And this one, it's so far removed from all that. And, I mean, it's obviously part of Babylon 5, and you've got the Drazis and Alien. But it is so pure, boiled down to just the two characters in a room talking. And like you say, the whole level of control of reality. It's the Prisoner episode of Babylon 5.
Yeah, it is very theatrical in its setting, the way it's shot, the way it's spaced, very much like a one act or three act play, actually.
Also, I'm just thinking of this. Am I right in saying that apart from where the commercial breaks were in the original transmission, there are no time jumps in this episode?
There are. I mean, there's a certain lapse time. After Sharon eats the sandwich.
But I think there's also a black frame in there where our commercial break originally went.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, right. There's no time jumps in terms of the story while we're watching it. Like,
right.
You know, yes, you're right.
Yeah, it is basically a play where the curtain goes down with a commercial break. And then we get to the next act.
Correct. Yeah, and I think, you know, Bruce Boxleitner, he really conveys that physical and psychological torment that Sheridan is in. You know, his every motion, and it's little things. I'm thinking of there's a shot where I think after he's drunk the seltzer water, whatever it is that the interrogator gives him after he's eaten the sandwich, and he's, you know, the interrogator tells him to sit in the chair, and he does, and then they turn the shackles, you know, they activate the shackles again, and his expression is like, why, you know, almost like, huh, I'm doing what you asked, I'm not going to cause any problem, you know, but it's all nonverbal, and it's all just in his eyes.
Yeah, what got me about that scene was you see him struggle to stand up, and you get a sense of the physical toll that the effects of the poisoned food had on him. And even though he has trouble standing fully standing up, once he gets there, he regains a bit of himself and, you know, says, okay, I'm ready now. And then he that gets shaken a little bit with the shackles. He goes, what? Come on, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out where I remember reading this, but I seem to have read somewhere that when he was shackled to the chair, Bruce Boxleitner actually refused to be released between takes to make the whole thing more realistic.
Really?
So he actually was strapped to that chair for probably a couple of hours on end.
We'll have to ask Jeffrey, see what he can remember that when he gets back on again. Yeah, it's an intense episode. There's no doubt about it, and it does stand in stark contrast to the previous episodes, which are not sprawling, but they are, you know, across the galaxy. We're with the fleet as they're heading toward Earth. We're on Mars with Garibaldi as he finally learns the truth in so many ways. That's the epic quality of the Babylon 5 story, and this is, you know, the intimate part of it, you know, just two people in a room. So let me ask you another question. One of the themes that comes up, I think as you touched on, Yarsto, is the nature of reality, and we've talked about the nature of truth. The interrogator tells Sheridan that truth is fluid, and he uses Sheridan's comment about it's lunch somewhere in order to get the sandwich. But Sharon also uses that again to tell his tormentor that, you know, if the truth is fluid, then I can fight against the state and I can win every time I say no. So do you see that as the fatal flaw in the argument of the state, or do you think that that's, you know, Sheridan's grasping at straws to try to keep himself afloat in the face of a reality that's coming unhinged.
I see that as Sheridan hanging on to reality and basically saying, well, you can say we control reality and you can say the truth is fluid, but if the truth is fluid, you can't control reality. So it's really, even in the state he's in, still really holding on to reality and picking apart the argument because it actually makes no sense.
Was he hanging on to reality or is he hanging on to his reality?
I think his.
Yes, because his version of reality, yeah. Probably. But yeah, that's closer to reality than anything they're trying to force him.
Yeah, because the whole point of the exercises the interrogator was saying was to make him come over to their reality so they could get what they wanted from him. So he's hanging on to what he still believes is the truth. And I think that was reinforced with his vision of the land, both in the room and as he's being wheeled away to what he thinks is his death. You know, he sees her as the last thing he sees before he goes, you know, to his end.
Do you have anything worth living for?
Yeah. And Gary is now telling me that the comment you read about Bruce came from the Galactic Gateway site.
Thanks, Gary.
Yeah. All right. Well, what else do we need to say about this episode?
Not much. It's just for some reason this episode made me think of a book that I had heard about. I haven't actually read it because apparently it's nearly impossible to get these days. But Colonel Paul M. A. Linnebarger, who most people know as Cordwainer Smith, wrote a book for the Army called Psychological Warfare in the early 50s. And apparently it's still used in several
wow.
circles in the military. Yeah. I have seen a copy of it. I know it exists. I actually have a partial copy of it somewhere buried in my in my extensive collection of stuff. But I actually haven't read all of it. But the stuff that they did in World War I, World War II, other wars in the early 20th century, just from a military standpoint, from a civilian standpoint, is intriguing. And to see a lot of those kind of things echoing still, you know, in the 21st century, in the 23rd century, interesting what people will go to try to control other people's minds.
Well, JMS has gone on record as saying that, you know, he believes that while we'll get out into space and we'll leave the planet behind, we're not going to leave behind those things that are part of the human experience.
True.
And, you know, that all, you know, includes the ability to achieve great things and the capacity for joy and love, but also the capability of inflicting horrible torment on our fellow man. It's interesting you bring up that book. You know, I had never heard of it, but I imagine that JMS, who is apparently a very well-read fellow, I can see him having come across something like that.
I wonder. I mean, the only reason I know about it is because I was doing some research, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, on Cordwainer Smith. And I found out some of the stuff he'd written under his real name and not his sci-fi nom de plume. And I was like, whoa, that sounds like an intriguing book. And this is before the World Wide Web, before there's actually a lot of, you know, before the internet was extensive as it is now. And I couldn't find a copy of it. But someone was able to get me, like, the content and some of the illustrations, you know, copies of it. So, but I, you know, I wonder, because since it's such a hard book to get a hold of, I wonder if JMS did read it, if it, or what influenced his construction of this episode. I would love to find that out.
Yeah, because the one thing is it really does not, you know, it could so easily fall into cliche, and it doesn't. You know, it keeps, it, you know, even having seen it as evidenced by our discussion tonight, it still remains open for interpretation. You know, you have to wonder, you know, what kind of game is being played. Again, you know, I think back to the to that scene where the interrogator says, look, you know what, all they want is a confession. They want it to be real, but if they have to fake it, they will. So here's your last chance. And just, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not even quite sure how to describe it at this point. I'm just impressed that it doesn't, you know, we know who, from our end of things, who the obvious bad guys are, but they never play to that mustache twirling convention.
Yeah. And Gareth just pointed out in the chat room that JMS has a background in psychology, so
mm-hmm.
you'd probably have run into something like this.
Do they have classes in psychological warfare? I wonder.
I don't know whether they do, but didn't he also have contacts in... I think that's what led to Changeling, right? He had contacts in a police department somewhere.
No, police interrogation would run similar lines, perhaps.
Exactly. So it's a lot of those interrogation techniques. I've read about this, not a lot, but a little, for stuff I've been writing myself. And a lot of those interrogation techniques are really about control the environment, make sure there's nothing to distract them from being questioned, which is why you get the bare room and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, maybe this was just his vision of classic interrogation techniques taken up a couple of centuries. After all, most of the history of technology is human beings developing new ways to be nasty to each other.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true.
Technology, finding new ways to kill you since 2000 BC.
And I have to wonder, how does those interrogation techniques work on people who are mentally flighty? Because they can do a ooh shiny moment in their own head. So they're distracting themselves. I know this because it happens to me a lot.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think we've covered everything.
I think so too.
I agree.
And on that note, I will do another ooh shiny moment. And what promo is Brad going to drop in now? Let's ponder that while he actually gets one for us.
Hi, I'm Brian Richardson, host of What the Cast, the podcast that has a little something for everyone. We talk about current events.
I'm in the opinion that Wikipedia should be a new wonder, the modern great library of Alexandria.
It's like the Library of Alexandria written on Etch-a-Sketches. People keep coming by and shaking them every once in a while.
Movies.
Well, what's your biggest problem with the movie?
That Michael Bay!
Okay, no.
The
listen
Island!
To hot robot-on-robot action.
Science fiction.
See, actually, the first 30 minutes of that film really were a good story about a boy and his secretly transforming car.
So it's like Harlan Ellison's A Boy and His Dog, just without the dog.
Exactly.
And the Harlan Ellis.
And every once in a while, math.
Ask me how I rated the movie on a scale from 1 to 5. I said a 5. On a scale from 1 to 10, what would you rate it? I'd say about an 8.
So you're not very good at this whole division and fraction thing.
Someone went to public schools.
So join myself, Crispy, Steven, and Patrick for What the Cast, available at whatthecast.com.
And we're back to wrap up this week's episode.
Yeah, something that I wanted to mention last week, and I failed because it just kind of ran out of my little tiny brain. Through Mike Smithwick, who is a regular listener to the Babcast, I have participated in a couple of deep geeking excursions on the Apollo program. James DeRuvo, who has been doing a podcast called Conversations with Apollo, invited Mike, and then through Mike, me, to discuss the Apollo moon missions. And we've been doing them for each month that they've come up. It's the 40th anniversary of the various missions. So we have done deep geeking on Apollo 7 and Apollo 8. Apollo 9 will be coming up soon. So go to apollotalks.com. I'll get the link up on the website and look for those. But the podcast is very interesting because James interviews, he's got an interview with Ed Mitchell, who was on Apollo 14, if I remember right. But he also interviews individuals who were working at the tracking stations, involved at mission control. So you get a real broad spectrum of people who are involved with that program. It's really fascinating.
Cool.
I especially like the way you said, "I've been on it, but it's very interesting."
Well, the last one we did for Apollo 8, he had on two Australian men who were at the honeysuckle tracking station down there. And you know what? It was as much fun to just be quiet and listen to these guys talk about what it was like to be tracking spacecraft on its way to the moon. And, you know, the trials and tribulations of keeping that contact going. So I highly recommend it if you're a space buff. And then, yeah, I talk a little bit, but I save that mostly for here.
As well you should.
Yeah.
So, is that it for emails?
Yeah, that's pretty much for news. You know, quiet on the email front. We got a couple little messages in with some links, and I don't have those in front of me because I'm just a lazy slob. But we'll get this posted up on the website.
I'm hoping we get a lot of feedback from Ed Wasser's interview, because he was truly astounded that that he was our most requested guest.
Yeah. And I gotta say, I almost have to apologize to all the listeners. You know, I had some questions in my mind, but once he told the story about holding his grandchild and saying, "What do you want?" and that voice, it was like I was done. That was it.
That was hilarious.
Yeah. Well, one thing I can tell you is, after summer, let it slip in the chat room. I told a friend of mine over Skype what the episode was going to be. And yeah, I've been getting virtual hugs for a week now. So I think some people are a bit excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, Gary alone sent me like three emails this morning. "Hey, where's the episode? Is the episode up yet? I can post it for you if you need." I'm like, dude.
Yeah, it was a fun interview. It was a little bit short, but you know, Ed kind of took the ball and ran with it. It was great.
Yeah.
So, I have to confess, I haven't had time to listen yet, so looking forward to that one still.
Excellent.
Yeah, a lot of people are.
Yeah, so like I said, hopefully we'll get a lot of feedback. This was what people were waiting for, and we finally brought it to them. And we can now take a breath and sit back and work on getting interviews with the next batch of people we haven't talked to yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we got some things that'll be coming along. So
cool.
Anybody got anything else?
Nope. All right. I'm done.
I think so.
Okay. If you want to send in your own comments for Tim to read on the show, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. We also have a set of forums over at farpointforums.com. Go over and check those out. Add to the never-ending thread. I can't even keep up with that anymore. Or if you want to call in your own voicemail and either leave a prank call or hang up on us like others have, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Are you sure it's the year the Great War came upon us all? After all, reality is a fluid thing.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the poisoned corned beef sandwich.